All right, I guess we'll go ahead and begin. Thank you for attending session 377, titled What Mormons Can Learn From... Welcome to the closing evening session for Saturday. Following this session, there will be a linger-longer picnic with music... I might say this not wrong... with the Angela Soff or Soffy Band, I'm not sure which. Following the music, there will be an evening storytelling with Robert Kirby, Gina Colvin, and Courtney Clark Kendrick. Tickets are limited, but are available for purchase at the registration desk. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Please silence your cell phones and remain respectful. As you leave us tonight, we want to thank you all for coming and being part of the Sunstone Symposium. You have now participated in a tradition of Mormon history that is over 40 years old. Mormonism can be what we make of it, and your participation helps make Mormonism a little more diverse, interesting, and inclusive. Regardless of your relationship with the Restoration, we claim you as an important part of the community. You are wanted. Your voice is needed. You claiming the identity in your own way is an act of resistance against hate, division, and intolerance. Thank you for having the courage to show up and engage at Sunstone. Please support Sunstone by making a donation, subscribing to the magazine, and by attending our regional conference. You are all invited to attend our next regional conference in Glasgow, Scotland, on September 1st. Sounds like fun, but it's a little pricey, I'm sure. Register at sunstone.org. This session is 90 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within that framework so that folks can get out on time for dinner. About this presentation... As a New World Restoration religious movement, Mormonism has much to teach the world, but it also has much to learn from teachers, prophets, visionaries, artists, scientists, movers, and shakers from other traditions. This session includes seminal lessons for Latter-day Saints from the world's great teachers, texts, traditions, and creative expressions. Robert A. Rees is the Director of Mormon Studies at Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. Clifton Holt Jolly is known as a newspaper columnist and host of PBS's Civic Dialogue. He has been published in the New York Times, Dialogue, Sunstone, Western Folklore, and other venues. His two PBS documentaries were nominated for Emmys. Phil Barlow is a Harvard-trained scholar who specializes in American religious history, religious geography, and Mormonism. In 2007, he became the country's first full-time professor of Mormon studies at a secular university, having been appointed as the Leonard J. Arrington Chair of Mormon History and Culture at Utah State University. Joe Overton is an enrolled member of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe. She has a bachelor's degree in social work and is a passionate advocate for the marginalized. Her 11 grandchildren are her deepest joy, and she happily spends a lot of time planning activities to pass on in other ways. She spends a lot of time planning activities to pass on the ways of her people to the next generation. And now for the presentation.
One of the questions I ask my students at Graduate Theological Union. At the end of the semester, I say to them, thank you for teaching me about your religion and for expanding my vision and understanding. And I want to tell you things about your religion for which I have holy envy. And I do that. And then I say, I'm curious if there's anything that you've studied in Mormonism about which you might have holy envy. And it turns out that they do. Probably the most common thing is that they're envious that we have an open canon. They're envious that we have a Divine Mother, even though we don't say much about her. There are other things that they find interesting, and in fact, one said, "I happen to," because they're required to go to a 3-block Mormon service as part of their assignment in my class, and one of them said, "I happen to go to your." The Sunday that I went, somehow the little children were in charge, and they were speaking and singing and praying. I was so impressed, and I'm going to do that when I graduate and get my and I have my own church. There are so many things that as I've grown up in Mormonism and traveled in various countries and done things that I continue to find my Mormonism expanded and my Christianity, my humanity expanded by the things that I learn from others. And so the idea of having a Sunstone session devoted to what we can learn from was something that kind of interested me. And it also interested me because it meant that I could do a Sunstone symposium and I didn't have to do any preparation. I could just find good people who could do it. So this new session of Sunstone, the purpose of which is to manifest Joseph Smith's vision, quote, "Mormonism is truth, and every man and woman who embraces it feels himself or herself at liberty to embrace every truth. The first and fundamental principle of our holy religion is that we believe that we have a right to embrace all and every item of truth." Recently, I finished reading Peter Enns' fascinating book, The Sin of Certainty, which I recommend highly. Why God desires our trust more than our quote-unquote correct beliefs. We Mormons tend to be so set, so certain, so satisfied that we have the truth. We are certain and satisfied not only of our beliefs, but of our culture, our politics, our history, of everything. Speaking of someone who exuded absolute conviction, Thoreau was reported to have said he was so Mormon-like. Conviction is important, but like all virtues, in the extreme it can be, at the least, irritating, at the worst, dangerous. I asked gospel doctrine class recently, what does a mother ask her Jewish daughter when she comes home from Hebrew school? I knew they would all say, what did you learn? I said, no. She says, did you ask good questions? Mormons are very good at giving answers, not so good at asking or answering questions. Latter-day Saints tend to be insular and self-referential, if not self-reverential. This can be seen in the fact that our source for most of our sacrament service addresses is, as well as many of our priesthood and relief society lessons, are the addresses of general authorities, which often are also relying on the talks and addresses of previous general authorities. We are cautioned to be aware of outside sources and to stick to the manual, and particularly in our lessons, to use the King James Bible. I was sitting in gospel doctrine class a couple of weeks ago in my ward, and the teacher asked for people to read passages from the lesson, and I volunteered, and I started reading, and I hadn't thought to bring anything other than the NIV, which I find helpful, and I started reading from it, and people were saying, "Now that's the wrong, what are you doing? What are you reading from?" And I said, "Oh." And a person next to me said, "He's reading from the NIV." And the high councilman sitting next to me said, "That's a false Bible." I told him I had five different false Bibles in my bookshelf. The impulse for this session is the question, what can we learn that we don't already know? What can we learn from other religions, from Jews, Buddhists, Muslims, Quakers, Native Americans? What can we learn from great historical or contemporary figures, Augustine, Hildegard of Bingen, Buddha, Harriet Tubman, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Mary Magdalene, a bunch of others? What can we learn from great writers, from Emily Dickinson, Plato, George Eliot, Virginia Woolf, Toni Morrison, Maxine Hong Kingston, Shakespeare, Rumi? What can we learn from great texts, from the Quran, the Vedas, the Gilgamesh, the Iliad, the Tao Te Ching? What can we learn from practically all of those things in the world that have something to teach us? Joseph Smith declared, "When things that are of the greatest import are passed over by weak-minded men and women without even a thought, I want to see truth in all of its bearings and hug it to my bosom." He also said, "The things of God are of deep import, and time and experience and careful and ponderous and solemn thoughts can only find them out. Thy mind, O man or woman, if thou wilt lead a soul unto salvation, must stretch as high as the utmost heavens and search into and contemplate the darkest abyss and the broadest expanse of eternity." When you climb up a ladder, Joseph Smith said, you must begin at the bottom and ascend step by step until you arrive at the top. And so it is with the principles of the gospel. You must begin with the first and go on until you learn all the principles of exaltation, but it will be a great while after you have passed through the veil before you have learned them. And President Hubie Brown, whose grandson spoke at a session of this symposium just a couple of hours ago, told the students at BYU, "While I believe all that God has revealed, I'm not sure that I believe, I'm not quite sure that I understand what he has revealed, and the fact that he has promised further revelation is to me a challenge to keep an open mind and be prepared to follow wherever my search for truth may lead." And then he said this to the students at BYU, "We have been blessed with much knowledge and revelation from God, which in some part the world lacks. But there is an incomprehensibly greater part of truth which we must yet discover. Our revealed truth should leave us stricken with the knowledge of how little we really know. It should never lead to an emotional arrogance based upon a false assumption that we somehow have all the answers, that we in fact have a corner on truth, which we do not." And recently, President Dieter Uchtdorf said, "We seek for truth wherever we may find it. Yes, we do have the fullness of the gospel, but that does not mean we know everything. In fact, one of the principles of the restored gospel is our belief that God will yet reveal many great and important things. So we continually seek truth from all good books and other wholesome sources. If there's anything virtuous, lovely, or of good report, or praiseworthy, we seek after these things. And we will learn that intelligence cleaves into intelligence, wisdom receives wisdom, and truth embraces truth." So I'm very pleased tonight that we have three people who will teach us things that we hopefully do not know or can know better. We will begin with Philip Barlow, who will announce his what he's going to teach us, followed by Joe Overton, who will do us, and we will conclude, if there's any time left, with Clifton Jolly. And hopefully we will have time for discussion or for you to say what you think we should be learning from. And I'm very open to suggestions as to who might participate in next year's session of the symposium. Phil?
Hello, Stephen. Friends, I'm pleased to be with you tonight. Thanks to my friend Bob Reese, the endlessly imaginative Bob Reese, who has called us together in the spirit of some of Joseph Smith's later teachings in the last years of his life that got compressed into what Latter-day Saints knows a 13th article of faith, which invites Mormons to seek after that which is good, true, and beautiful, whatever its source, anything that's of good report or praiseworthy, adopt and make a part of one's Mormonism. So I'm a grateful Latter-day Saint, practicing Latter-day Saint, informed by that invitation. And what I thought at Bob's invitation that I would chat with you about for a few minutes is what Buddhism can teach or has taught this Latter-day Saint. And since we're allowed 15 or 17 minutes or so, this will not be a mini course on Buddhism, nor am I particularly an expert about Buddhism, but it's rich and wonderful, as all great religious traditions are, or at least there's many things to be mined from them. Like all of you, I have many Latter-day Saint friends who are no longer Latter-day Saints while they remain friends, or who are struggling with their Mormon identity and faith for various reasons. Often when they take a course out of the church, they idealize something else, some non-Mormon thing, secularism, for instance, or humanism, or certainly Buddhism. I've known a number of my friends to idealize Buddhism, so I don't have in mind some idealized Buddhism by way of a Yeah, just creating a movement that doesn't really exist. I know enough Buddhism and enough Buddhists and enough sanghas and some Buddhist monasteries to know that all the problems of the human condition beset them, like they do the Mormon world or the secular world. Oh, thanks, Earl. Is that better? Please repeat yourself if I mumble. My tabernacle choir singing mother always taught me to use my diaphragm, and I always got a C minus on obedience to that Thelma commandment. So I'm talking about a real Buddhism, and I'd like to talk about Buddhism through the prism of a Colorado poet who wears her Buddhism lightly in her poetry, but ubiquitously, if that ugly word is really a word with an L-Y on the end of it. She walks lightly in the world, and that attracts me. She walks insightfully, and that's the window I'd like to present a couple of Buddhist ideas. At first glimpse, the world of Buddhism, the world of Mormonism might seem in considerable tension. They both value love and compassion and service, etc. They have much in common. But Buddhism might be symbolized, is symbolized, but I'm going to choose the symbol of the lotus to represent some things about Buddhism. And I'm going to choose the symbol of Deseret to represent Mormonism. So if you can hold together that little beehive Deseret thing with the lotus flower and see what happens in your mind, you can see that there might be some tensions. Mormonism, as you all know, inclines to being busy as a bee, being industrious, serving, doing so in organized ways, having respect for authority and organization and discipline. They care about eternity, they care about doing, they care about eternal progression. They believe that existence is a good thing, superintended and intended by the divine. They say yes to experience, and we might compress all of that for shorthand for this afternoon. Mormons are interested in becoming, eternal becoming. Buddhism, by contrast, inclines to contemplation, even formal meditation, quietude, acceptance, letting go, releasing of attachment, of a kind of desire or clutching that imprisons us, even of ideas, let alone material goods, even of ourselves. So classic forms of Buddhism are fundamentally about solving the tangle of human consciousness with its intrinsic suffering by surrendering that addictive clutching, even of selves, and recognizing the passing, the transience, the impermanence of all things. And ultimately, nirvana is achieved by the dissolution of self. Okay? Becoming, Deseret, unbecoming, lotus. A bit of attention at the fundamental directions of these two movements. But friction or tension is not necessarily a bad thing. Centripetal and centrifugal forces are what hold atoms and molecules and solar systems and galaxies and the cosmos, superclusters of galaxies, together. Or I try to minimize friction when I'm lubricating my car, but I try to maximize it when I'd like to brake promptly. Friction isn't a bad thing. It's just a force to be navigated and used. And so paradoxically, the apparent juxtapositions, tensions, or frictions between the lotus and Deseret can address each other helpfully, like centrifugal and centripetal forces, and work together for a 13th article of faith sort of a result. I'd like to focus here through Rosemary Traumer on two strands of Buddhism. that have affected my Mormon life. The first is attention. Buddhism, Buddhist practice works very hard at fostering attention of a particular sort that we'll talk about. And secondly, the principle of letting go, of accepting, of not holding on to that which, one, you can't successfully, and two, helps ultimately cause a kind of suffering. Now, I have to admit that as a Latter-day Saint, I like Mormonism's orientation to perpetual becoming. I embrace that. I'm prepared to defend it. I like it more than unbecoming. Yet becoming what we ought to become may entail, fruitfully, a letting go, an unbecoming of some parts of ourselves, maybe a better path to becoming. So those are the two principles I'd like to meditate on by sharing four trauma poems with you and making brief comment on them, and that's all I'll attempt in the minutes that are left. This first one is a poem called Because Sometimes I Get That No Gets Me Nowhere. Rosemary Traumer often enough starts a poem by quoting somebody else and meditating about it. So here she quotes Hermann Hesse, who's famous in the Western world for his novel Siddhartha, but this is her quotation from him is taken from a Hesse collection called Wandering. This is Hesse. "You say yes to the sunlight and your pure fantasies, so you have to say yes to the filth and the nausea. Everything is within you, gold and mud, happiness and pain, the laughter of childhood and the apprehension of death. Say yes to everything. Shirk nothing. Don't try to lie to yourself." And here's Traumer's poem in response. "It is not hard to say yes to the nausea when it's your son's and he's lying on your belly on the old wicker couch with foam cushions and wave follows wave and he shivers. There is nothing romantic about this. There is no way to say no. But there is love, and there is yes in the way that you carry him to the shower, how he dangles his head from the crook of your arms, how his legs are more fabric than flesh. Do not squander this moment. Cradle him as the warm water falls. Choose to be naked and covered in bile, to carry the weight of the one that you love, to bathe his flushed face, to be soft, to croon nothing but comfort, to baptize yourself in this moment. Sunshaft in the window, gold in the spew, yellow smell, quiet splash on the wall. Memorize the thin staffs of his ribs, the startling muscle of his 5-year-old limbs. Already you cannot explain how you came this far by some miracle to this small white tub where the water heater has run out of warmth and the boy loans all of his weight to your arms. Do not squander this vomit-filled moment." That's Barlow, a little less poetic than Traumer. Mormonism says yes to experience, and that's not an obvious conclusion to all the world's philosophies and religious traditions. Mormonism says yes to human experience, but an informed yes may require attention and acceptance, even of hard, unpleasant things. Joseph Smith's poetic prose in the 122nd section of what Mormons know as the Doctrine and Covenants, in a prison cell, being offered rotted human flesh for dining, and other such traumas. All these things shall give us experience and be for thy good. Joseph has the Lord saying, that sentiment may be put in dialogue with traumas. Do not squander this moment. Second poem is called Going Your Way. You idiot, is what you say to the driver five cars ahead of you on the two-lane road that winds through the river canyon. There is no passing lane, and you feel the crushing of the minutes as they rub against each other while the white SUV five cars ahead does not pull over in the wide spot on the road where all conscientious slow drivers know to pull over to let the other drivers pass. Idiot, you grumble, and miss any beauty outside the window, focused as you are on the speedometer and the brake. Once it was you, a girl of 15, who drove so cautiously the windy roads to church on a Sunday morning that first day of Mass, or that first day with your driver's permit. And who was it in the long line behind you who called the police to report a drunk driver? When they pulled you over, the two squad cars with their blaring lights, you didn't cry when the officers laughed. There was warmth in their relief to find that you were not drunk, but young. No, you cried after they walked away, cried all the way to Mass. Bless them, the irate ones, the ones who fume in the back, the ones who think furious thoughts. That's right. Bless yourself. You, the livid one, can you find a way to love even her, this hurler of names, this one who disdains the others going the same way she is going? Laugh at her, if you can, a real laugh. Tell her you get it. It's frustrating. Tell her we are all traveling the same winding road toward evening, toward morning, toward grace. I think that all remembering entails also a forgetting. Clutching attentiveness to some things means inattention to others. Exasperation, impatience, and excess confidence in our own victimization is sometimes a good way to lower our IQ and to live a petty, less charitable, less awake, and less happy day. And I remind myself that how we live our days is how we live our lives. Third poem, Walking Before the Midnight. In the dark, you lose track of any lines that say, you are here. And the night holds you like a lover with hands somehow everywhere. And the stars keep thousands of secrets, and sometimes they spill. And if you have a question, it comes to meet you, whether or not you've dared to ask it. Here trauma reminds me, or I appropriate trauma to remind myself, that some forms of attention involve vulnerability and surrender, even surrender of light, even surrender of our customary senses, even surrender of answers, in favor of making cognitive or emotional or spiritual space for the illumination of darkness, of openness to other ways of knowing, of allowing a question that may open vistas of spiritual and life growth. Without knowing Traumer's poem, a son of mine who lives in Boston recently had an experience where he was gifted by his mother an experience in a sensory deprivation tank. In it, and he was, like all of us, being bothered by various forces of life and decisions to be made. The experience of being deprived of his senses temporarily, like Traumer's midnight walk, revealed something to him. The word reveal comes etymologically from a concept of uncovering. Being deprived of his sight and his hearing allowed him to hear and see in a different way, to realize something that changed the course of his path, changed his course. Fourth and last poem, Obeying the Impulse. The world exists. Oh, I remind you that most major forms of Buddhism are atheistic. They are, depending on one's definition of religion, it is a religion, but not a theistic one. And that might help with her opening lines. Obeying the Impulse. The world exists just fine without our appreciation. It is not for us that the dandelions bloom in tides of yellow across the valley floor. Not for us that the elk stream in a slow brown current before disappearing into Engelmann spruce. And then there are the tiny empires of grasshoppers, ants and bees, and the underground realms of prairie dogs, and worms and rhizomes and moles, intricate and entirely oblivious to our praise. Yet still this drive toward gratitude, still this tug to pull over the car and marvel, this impulse to offer the world our attention, as if being very still and very alert is as vital to the moment as scurry and swerve and scamper and strive. Perhaps it is. Perhaps it is vital, just as vital to the moment. I think we do not see well without gratitude. It's a form of consciousness, and it presupposes attention. If, as I was taught as a good Mormon boy, obedience is the first law of heaven, it helps to learn that the term obedience traces its origins not to saluting and marching without thought in lockstep to some or another task, but rather to hearing, to attention, with an implied responsiveness. I think, in fact, that religion is best reconstructed to mean not a series of doctrines or moral mandates necessarily, or religion can't be reduced to that, but it's possible to reconceive religion as response to a kind of beckoning, an invitation. Ms. Trommer and her Buddhist inflections nourish strands of my Mormon self, inviting me not to squander this day, this moment, with grasping, with inattention, or with errant attention to the many distractions that beset us, we who have been called the most distracted generation in human history. Thanks.
Hit B again? Is that what I do? Who told me? Do I just hit B again? Pardon? Do I hit B again to make it go? Sorry. Oh, I think we're good. Got it. Okay. I know.
You have to put it back up.
Oh, I do? Okay, I'll try. I'll do my best. Thank you. A little shorter, perhaps younger. Definitely, depending on your, gender binary, whatever. And I'm Jo Overton, and I'm not a college professor, although I have student taught a couple college classes on Native American studies at the U, and I need to. I have a dry mouth, so I'm trying to pre-chew so that I can talk. Anyway, so I'd say about myself that I'm an urban Indian, which is what they call one who wasn't raised on the reservation. However, I have deep, deep roots in my tribe, which the federal government calls the Rosebud Sioux, we call ourselves the Sichangu Lakota. My family is in all of the Native American history books. Whether or not they actually exist in any of the conquerors' books is a whole other question. But should you read any Native American history, there's plenty there, and I am proud to be a part of them and humbled to speak. And I want you to understand that this is just my point of view. I speak for no one but myself in the things that I've learned. And if you should hear somebody else say, oh, no, the Lakota way is this way, I don't, you know, go with whatever. It's like I can't, I'm not going to defend my own ignorance in everything. So today I'm talking about the way of the Lakota. And is it only for the Lakota? We shall see. So first we're going to speak about Black Elk. He is an Oglala Lakota holy man. He's known for his visions. Perhaps one that would seem vaguely familiar of a straight path that leads to a sacred tree that will save you. Maybe that's familiar a little bit. And he wrote two books. One is The Sacred Pipe, and the other one is Black Elk Speaks. And what I'm going to be talking about is a concept that he calls the Red Road, which is the straight path. Yes?
So is it
Oglala?
Oglala, your tribe?
No. Sichangu Lakota is my tribe. But the Lakota people claim Black Elk as their own, because he is, you would call him Sioux, which, you know, they did for a long time, and so, yeah. And I'm not one to read the PowerPoint things, because you guys all know how to read, and I'm not going to read it to you. But I'm hoping it gives you a chance to look and read while I'm talking a little bit about the Red Road, which is, now I got to get out my notes. Okay. So he was a holy man, and in here, at the very end, they speak of the sacred sweat lodge ceremony, and there are seven sacred ceremonies to the Lakota. I am not speaking of that for any of you. You are not of the people. That is not for you. But there are things within the Lakota belief system that you will find very valuable. Seven is a sacred number, and the sweat lodge is for the people. And if you're invited to a sweat lodge, as long as you're not paying for it, be aware, if you're paying for it, you're already off the road. Whoever's doing it isn't doing it well, because it should never be paid for. But the sweat lodge, if you're invited by someone to go, you're welcome to go. I'm just saying that's not a sacred ceremony for you. Just like you tell somebody who didn't have a temple recommend, you know, that's not for you. That's not your path yet, or may never be. So hopefully you've got a chance. But I am going to speak to you. This is some more of what Black Elk speaks of, and I'll leave it up here for you a little while. And it's really important to understand how much it means to commune with the Great Spirit, to begin to understand what path you're on and where are you supposed to be. What are you learning? Are you growing? Are you becoming who? Are you being who you're supposed to be? All of those things. And so those are really important things. And so here are some of Black Elk's quotes, and like I said, I'm not going to read them to you. If you didn't finish them, feel free to read his books. They are awesome. So I'm going to speak to you of the seven values of the Lakota life. And the first one that I will speak of is prayer. And once more, I'm not going to read this to you because you can read. And it's that communication, that depth. It comes with deep humility. It comes with the desire to study these things out in your mind, to speak with others, to read, to find things, all those things. And so many things can be a prayer: to hold the hand of someone who's dying, to be the one to hold your friend or even a stranger as their shoulders shake, sobbing, to be the one who runs in instead of runs out. Those things are all prayers in their own way. And I think that of the sacred things, the Mormons or the LDS people, which I used to be, I'm kind of ex-Mo now, but it for me, people would ask, they would say, how do you be Lakota and Mormon? How do you do this? And I said, it braids beautifully together. Because look at this. Look at this prayer. Look at, who doesn't know about prayer? The LDS people are so good at prayer. So there are so many things that you can do that are prayers. And so your goal in life, you would want to be as present as possible in the moment so that whatever you're doing in that moment is a prayer. And I humbly hope that what I'm speaking to you is a prayer, because that is certainly my intent to do this. And so prayer is one of the seven values, and I'm sure you've already learned some of those things. And there's so much more to be learned. The next one, I'm not even trying for the Lakota, guys. I'm urban. I didn't get Lakota in school, and I am not going to mess myself up and be embarrassed by saying the Lakota words incorrectly. So I'm going to stick with the white man's thing that I learned in kindergarten in California. Although I will say what took us to California is the Indian relocation program that the United States government did. And so we were moved from the reservation to California. But respect is really important. Respect of the earth, our grandmother, the respect of other people, to respect our brothers and our sisters, which aren't just people. They are our four-leggeds, our two-leggeds. They are the tree. They are the rock. They are the wind. They are the rain. They are the volcano. These things, we're all connected to these things. You might think in your head that you're not connected to them, but the truth is you are. On the very deepest level of who you are, those essences of our molecules or atoms or all those things are all connected here on Earth. We existed before. We exist now. We will continue to exist. We are a circle that never ends. So that is all. And in that matter of respect, how important it is to say, oh, there's an anthill here. Shall I go stomp on it? Shall I stop and watch the ants for a little while here and wonder about their work, you know? And to take a moment and appreciate the things that are around you, to respect your elders. They've lived longer than you. They all have wisdom for you. It's really deeply important. And so respecting our children as they teach us, just so many things. So respect is just a very sacred and internal value that is given. And I learned these things as a child. However, my mother never said to me, Joe, I shall teach you the Lakota way of compassion today. And this is how you're going to learn it. Those were never the words. I never knew what they were. It took me growing up to begin to understand what those things were. And as I began to separate myself and realize that I live and walk in a world that isn't really my own internally, but yet I'm still here and trying to make sense of the whole thing, because I live in a community-based fashion. And caring and compassion is, yes. Oh, thank you. My daughter's keeping me on time. Thank you. I asked her to. Okay, this one particularly, they say, requires strength of heart and mind and true courage. Now, there is a long time ago, before the colonizers came, before they came, and then the part of the story is as they were there, there was an understanding that if your father or brother were killed, that it was okay to take revenge on another tribal member or whoever it was that killed this person. And it was okay to kill them because that's, you know, Judaic maybe, you know, and if you want to understand it that way. But there was the ultimate revenge. And you would take your best horse and you would go to their teepee and you would say, "You are my brother now." And they would be your brother, your father, whoever was missing. And they became that person for you. Well, the colonizers thought that that wasn't justice. And so they went out and found who they thought was the murderer and hung them instead. So, compassion and caring. It is so important to care for those that are less fortunate than you. It is to never walk by if you can stop and help and lend a hand. It's incredibly important. This is like a really big one. The next one is the way of honesty and truth. And basically, I am my word, whether I keep it or I break it. I am my word. What I have said are those things. And so it is our sacred obligation to stand in those moments for the things. And there are things that I say that are unpopular. I've gotten in trouble at church. I've gotten in trouble at school. I went to Catholic school. I was called a heathen. So for some of the things that I said, so, you know, stand for your truth and where you are. Honesty and truth. Generosity. This is really big. And my friends would ask me when my children were small, they said, "How come your kids share so well? How come your kids always share with each other, with everybody else?" And I'd go, "I don't know." It made me think, like, why? And I thought, because the baby that you just gave the graham cracker to, you say, "Oh, are you going to share with me?" And the baby holds the graham cracker out to you, and you take it, and you're like, "Thank you. Thank you for sharing. That was so yummy." And you start from their earliest days how important that compassion and generosity is. You teach that from their very earliest days, and it makes all the difference in the world. The next one is humility. Walk softly. Like I said, I'm just saying things for me, and please don't take me as being any sort of spokesperson for any Lakota beyond just what you're hearing right here. Not being humble, and it means not being proud. It means not bragging. It means turning the honor to others. It means not having to be right, even when you are right. It's really a tough one. I struggle with this one at times, about the being right part. And another one is wisdom. Wisdom, of course, comes from the Creator, the Holy Spirit, the Great Spirit. There are so many different words that we use for that, and use whatever word it is that brings you that joy, that's in your light, in your mind right now. You think, who is it that is the author of this? Holy Mother, whatever, those things, bring them into your life and allow them to bathe you in their wisdom, their knowledge, and pray and seek that wisdom and talk to the elders and talk to the children and say, "I need to learn how to laugh again. I forgot how." Okay, thanks, baby. And because a child will teach you how to laugh again, and they'll teach you how to forgive so quickly. So there's important things in wisdom from those that are older and younger, and also from, as again, from the earthquake, from the fire, from the flood, from the prairie dogs, the owls. They all have things to teach us. Wisdom will be found in all those things. And one of the most important things is that people are more valuable than any amount of money or possession, and to hold life sacred. I get a little bit caught up in this one's a little hard for me because it makes me late. a lot, because if I am on the phone with a friend, I have a really hard time saying, I need to go. How could whatever I'm doing next be more important than the conversation I'm having right in this moment? It almost never is. So I'm learning, though, in the world I live in, that I really need to say it sometimes, not so that other people, I'm respecting their time, and it's been a big lesson for me. So just let me say that. And my closing words for this are to pray for wisdom and to practice these values every day. These values are something every person can learn from. And if you're called into this room right now, these words are probably for you today, too. So thank you for letting me share this with you. And one last thing. And so it's written, in every place the Creator speaks, these values are the path to peace and harmony. For those who are willing to embark on the journey, the reward will be great. You're going to cry. You're going to be mad. You're going to be sad. You're going to laugh. And you're going to learn, and you are going to blossom even more into the person that you were always meant to be and always are. You're the one finding out. It's no secret except to you. The Creator knows who you are. You're just a little confused about where you are in that. So thank you for letting me share these few things with you.
The coldest three winters of my life, that's okay, were spent one winter on the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And Rosebud is a wonderful place, and Standing Rock is known as where the tribal police killed Sitting Bull. That's where I went. Yeah. Much of what I believe began as a religious practice in the 19th century, stressing the importance of continuing revelation, the autonomy of the individual believer to receive that revelation, and over time, the tradition which I find myself has been deeply influenced by American culture and Western values. The founder of my religion was a student of biblical literature and traditions and of Hebrew, forming a school at which to discuss, argue, and wonder about divine will. He believed that regular worship needed reform so as more to stress the individual quest for the divine, a quest for testimony to establish personal practices of worship and behavior. In the 1830s, the originator of my religious practice published a religious text that would lead to a westward migration of believers so as to continue to practice the new religion that today reaches around the world. I am a Mormon, and I am a convert to Reform Judaism, and what I've just read to you describes both of my religions, although one of the founders was a prophet and the other was a rabbi. Nauvoo is a Hebrew word that means to be comely, regardless of the nonsense that Fawn Brody published in No Man Knows My History and later corrected, alleging that the prophet made up the word. Although she probably was right that as soon as the prophet pronounced the name, many of the assembled Mormons were looking it up in their Hebrew dictionaries so as to prove the prophet, or in the case of my ancestors, probably to disprove him. Joseph had learned the Sephardic version of the word, Nauvoo, from his Hebrew teacher, Yosha Sisus, who was one of the foremost Hebrew scholars in America, hired to teach Hebrew to the prophet in Kirtland. Sisus later would write of the experience that Joseph and the group attending his lectures were not malingerers, but serious students of Hebrew. May I see by a show of hands how many of you brought your Hebrew dictionaries with you, as surely Joseph Smith would have done had he been attending this lecture.
Yeah, Bob.
Only one of us, I see. And he was forewarned. That dictionary was given to me by my wife's father, one of Reform Judaism's foremost cantors, the only cantor who, with a board of rabbis, assembled, wrote, and edited Gates of Repentance, which is this book. It's a book of prayer, and it's a book of songs in celebration of the holiest day of the Jewish year, Yom Kippur, the day when we confess to God our sins. In case we forget any of those sins, they are conveniently listed for us in this book, unlike Mormon hymnals that mention only one or two. I mention my wife's father because of the role he played in teaching me how to know, something we Mormons claim to be very good at. We brag about it in every fast and testimony meeting. We are commanded to it in general conference. We seek unwavering testimonies that cannot be challenged by troublesome details, such as facts. For such knowledge, George taught me a Hebrew expression, and I'm going to teach it to you now. It requires hand gestures. They're kind of signs and tokens, but they're not private. You can show them to anyone. You put your hands out like this. Please, hands. Everyone put your hands out. And then, in a gesture in which you bring the hands wide and shrug the shoulders, you say, "Who knows?" I can also do it in Yiddish, but it comes out the same. When I was studying Judaism with Rabbi Rosenberg, he told me this story. It's a story about knowing. An elderly rabbi retired from the rabbinate, settled in a small Eastern European shtetl, where he attended a synagogue led by a young rabbi. Generally, he was respectful of the young man. The older rabbi took his place Fridays and Saturdays in his place of honor, but he did not speak so as not to upstage the young rabbi. However, on one occasion, there was a great debate over a particularly difficult and ambiguous passage in Torah. So to resolve the argument and to save time, the old rabbi arose and gave his opinion, which he obviously considered a verdict. The young rabbi would have none of it, continuing with his explanation of the scripture. The elderly rabbi then began to argue with the young rabbi until finally the old man was exhausted, and as a final evidence of the truth of what he said, said, "Fine. As proof of my power to interpret scripture and life, I will perform a miracle. The next time we arrive here, the tree to the north of the synagogue will have been moved by God to the south." Needless to say, everyone attended services the following week, and so it was. To which the young rabbi replied, "Well, that's a neat trick, but to what purpose? Is the fruit easier to harvest? Is it sweeter to eat?" Obviously, another miracle was required, and the elderly rabbi intoned, "When we next arrive here, the stream beside the synagogue that runs down the hill will be running up the hill." And so it was. To which the young rabbi replied, "Another trick, and this time to a bad end. The stream no longer turns the mill wheel, we no longer can grind grain, and starvation is a real possibility." The old rabbi was done with arguing, done with simple miracles and stubbornness to disregard the profound and apparent wisdom that he himself proclaimed. And so he said, "Fine. If you will settle for nothing else, God will now announce from heaven that I am right." There was a thunderclap. An illumination brighter than the noonday sun. And God spoke. "He is right." The synagogue fell silent. No one spoke until the young rabbi looked to heaven and complained, "You know, we've been down here doing the best we can, and you say nothing. We come to temple our whole lives, and you say nothing. We pray to you and worship you and read your Torah and try to understand, and you say nothing. And now, you move our tree, you ruin our mill, and you tell us we have to believe what he says." And God again spoke, saying, "You know, he also has a point." This is so fundamentally Jewish that I will not define it for you. Jews consider scriptures to be conversations with God, more intended to teach how to inquire than how to believe. Joseph Smith's life and ministry and his entreaties of God and his complaints against God, recorded in the Doctrine and Covenants, I believe are inclined to teach us why it is important to argue with God, not what we should be arguing about, nor to spoon-feed us answers. These arguments that respect as much the complexity and opposition of events as the simplicity sometimes found to answer them are essential to Jewish belief and religion. Reformed Jews are permitted to believe in a diaspora of doctrine. There are Buddhist Jews and agnostic Jews and conservative and Orthodox Jews and at least one Mormon Jew. And we all believe many different things about many fewer miracles than Mormons believe. When I told my rabbi this, it first bothered me that I was raised in a tradition that has nearly as many answers as we have questions. He asked how I dealt with it. Well, at first I told him, it seemed to me like Jews discuss so much and dictate so little that you really don't believe much at all. And then I remembered what a guy I taught seminary with once said when I asked him how he reconciled some of the thornier details of Mormon history. And he said, "Well, I find that I believe more and more in less and less." Also very Jewish. My rabbi smiled and replied, "So, you've decided to believe less?" "No," I answered. "When I come up against an ambiguity in Torah and temple does nothing to help me resolve it, I just fill in with my Mormon doctrine." He smiled and said, "That's very interesting," which is about as severe a criticism as you get from a rabbi. "That's very interesting. Don't bring it up at temple." Jews do not seek converts. There are too many reasons for this to describe in a paper Bob Rees has given me insufficient time to present. But a lot of it has to do with a confusion about how one can be one thing and another. My father-in-law was very interested in excommunication. He knew that one of the reasons I was becoming a Jew was because all of my Mormon friends had been excommunicated. And so he said, "Please explain to me once again how a Mormon can cease to be a Mormon for what it sounds to me is being disagreeable, which all Jews are." And I was never able persuasively to explain to him that what you believe in Mormonism can sometimes seem as important as believing. Although I must say, Paul Toscano I would have excommunicated not for doctrine, but simply for being disagreeable. Paul and I went to school together. As I said, Jews don't seek converts, and this is for a lot of different reasons. And then there is also this exclusivist thing, which Reformed Jews deny. It's a part of the service that they say, we thank Yahweh for making us chosen, not to be better than other people, not to be put above other people, but as a service to the world. It's like Mormons, right? The Jewish tradition is that one must seek conversion and that one who seeks conversion must be turned away three times to be certain the convert also is certain. As I recalled, I was turned away many more times than that. And not because of someone's inspiration, but because of decisions and choices. Most of the things in life Reformed Jews believe are not dictated by God, but left for conversation and argument. We may seek inspiration, but what do we do when God is silent? Many Mormons believe even God's silence is a kind of answer, and perhaps. But perhaps God is more likely to comfort us when we make bad decisions because he hasn't answered than he is to actually answer. I had great difficulty becoming a Jew because I was waiting on God. I wanted a conversion experience such as a Mormon convert is taught to expect. My rabbi asked me, he said, there are some things I don't understand about this inspiration thing that you're waiting on. He said, would it help me to think of you more as a Christian or as a Mormon? And I said, you know, this is an interesting question. And in Judaism, there's a thought that sometimes the answer is in a really well-posed question. I said, and this answers something for me that I've been trying to resolve myself. Let me explain it to you this way. There are some apostles who, because of things Bob Rees published in Dialogue that I wrote, because of those things, they don't think I'm a very good Mormon. And my friend Zig Ziglar, who is one of the world's biggest Baptists, he doesn't think Mormons are Christians. So by someone's opinion, I am neither a Mormon nor a Christian. And my rabbi said, you know, I don't really understand what you just said, but it sounds really Jewish. I waited upon a conversion experience. But in the end, what I believe the word of God was to me is that most things in life, we simply get to decide, to choose. That's how Mormons believe we came to be here. We chose it. Choosing is both why we came and what we came for and what comes after. What can we learn from Reform Judaism? Perhaps how not to know, and at the same time, to know. But who knows? Thank you.
This convinces me that this was a good idea. So I would say that if any of you have questions to ask, Joe or Clifton or Phil, this is a good time to do it. Yes, back here. Use the mic here. We turn it your way.
Thank you, Dr. Rees. One of my envies of Mormonism is the temple. Its ritual and the theology I've gleaned from it from reading Dr. Sorensen and many other LDS scholars. I too come from an open canonical tradition that believes in eternal marriage as well as theosis at the ultimate end of things. I also love your idea of a lay ministry. I believe my tradition has restricted it to those of us who spend a lifetime in education and vocation, when I really believe the laity and professionals should work together. So here is what I feel Mormonism could learn from my tradition. The ancient temple type of liturgies that extended out of the early Jewish Christian church, I believe we could make wonderful liturgical and worship type of contributions, which my ministry, Sacro Kingship, attempts to do in these symposiums. Another thing that I think we could help with is tie Mormonism to the greater wisdom traditions that preceded our Catholic universal traditions. I believe the mystical traditions have much to teach us, and that's what Brother Joseph to me was. Thank you for everything you have given my life, and I hope I can share with you in scholarly efforts and other religious endeavors as we move Godward.
Thank you very much. I've been privileged to have as my students at Graduate Theological Union Franciscans, Dominicans, and Jesuits, and some of you may have read the article essay I published in Dialogue called Ordination and Blessing, which was about a wonderful experience I had with one of my Jewish students who became ordained at the end of his time with me, invited me to his ordination ceremony. It was a very beautiful experience in which, after his ordination, which was itself very impressive, with 40 Jesuits there being part of that, and when it came time for the Eucharist, I had been in meditation, and when I walked up to partake of the Eucharist, here was my student, Father Butterworth, handing me the Eucharist, and it was very touching to me that someone that I had taught was now doing something reciprocal to me. And I found him later in the sanctuary talking to his mother, and I said to her, "Your son is not only one of the brightest students I've ever had in 50 years of teaching, but he's one of the best men that I know, have known, best people I've known." And he turned to me and said, "Would you like a blessing?" And I said, "I would be honored for that." So here's this Jesuit priest laying his hands on a Mormon bishop, giving a beautiful blessing. His first blessing as a priest was to me. And that kind of grace that happened in that moment is part of what I have come to value and honor in the kind of tradition that Phil spoke about and that Joe spoke about and that Clifton did, that the expansiveness of all of those traditions and how much we can learn. And I find one of the greatest blessings to me teaching at a theological institution is I can learn from all of these very rich traditions, and they have much to teach me. And so thank you for that. I'm kind of a closet Episcopalian because I love the liturgy. I love the high expressions of the high church coming out of a low church tradition. I value both of them and wouldn't want to choose between them. So sometimes I find myself trying to bring some of that tradition into my service, but also finding myself sometimes on Sunday sitting in an Episcopal church or a black church. Glide Memorial Church in San Francisco is a wonderful place to go, and it's certainly something, if any of you heard the choir last night, we can look for the time in Mormon, I hope we can look for the time in Mormon services when we do a little bit more rocking and rolling than we do, which is practically none. Anyone else want to say something or ask a question of one of our guests? I hope that you have, if you have suggestions for what we might do next year, if there's some favorite, and this could be, it could be what can we learn from Mark Twain or Huckleberry Finn, or what can we learn from Toni Morrison, or what can we learn from the Tao Te Ching, what can we learn from the vast universe. I mean, the idea of eternity, which I sometimes as a younger man felt drove me to the edge of madness because I couldn't comprehend it. The only thing that kind of saved me is I would say, in eternity, I could learn all of the instruments, I could learn all of the sciences, I could listen to all of the music that's ever been composed in all of the worlds, the universe of worlds. And maybe after 100,000 years, I would say, I want to rest for 1,000 years, and I could just do that. And then I'd come back and say, I want to learn more. Anyway, I think the idea of learning and teaching from one another is one of the great excitements of life, that there is in God's creation that he has given. And this to me is part of the divinity of the Mormon God, is that he has planted wisdom in all of the traditions. And we sometimes think we have it all, and God is beckoning us, inviting us. Go talk to your Shinto friends, talk to your Zoroastrians, talk to the people who have some greater sense of the value of the earth than you presently do. It's one of the great things about the Native American traditions, that we could learn from them how bear's ears is not a place to get more oil, but a place to honor the people whose tradition that represents and whose petroglyphs and whose other things have something to teach us that help us to understand the sacredness of this great gift of the world which God has given to all of us, no matter what we believe. So there's much for us to do, and if any of you have things that you would like a future symposium to teach to you or present to you, then I'm all ears about that. Anyone want to say anything while we're still here and we have a few minutes?
Reform Judaism doesn't believe any of that. For my wife, I've got to say that, you know, Reform Jews are really uncertain about even this life. And so the idea of a life that follows this is, for instance, when I was trying to get Gail to marry me, she came to me and she grabbed me by the collar and she said, "Just because I'm marrying a Mormon, does that mean we're married forever?" And I said, "No, I don't think so."
And she said, "Thank heavens."
She said it was the most terrifying concept she had ever heard of. And it occurred to me, yes, it could be. So,
well, I think I can understand why she would say that to you. Thank you all, and thank our three presenters for enlightening us tonight.